Welcome everyone to this meeting of Santa Cruz eSchools. We are going to begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are there any agenda changes, deletions, additions?
None tonight.
Okay. All right. Then we'll move on to the superintendent's report. Oops. Oh, public comments. Where'd I go? Okay. Is there anyone who would like to speak to the board at this time? No? All right, then, superintendent's report. Okay.
Do you mind?
What's the date today? 26.
It's not working. Let me try again.
I'll just do the slide up.
I think okay. There it goes. So again, my report's always based on our district goals. Since we've last met, the MTSS core team met. And using input from our leadership team meeting or retreat, finalized our progress monitoring metrics for our MTSS work this year. And the elementary and middle school English Language Arts and English Language Development curriculum pilots are underway. Been meetings and work to that end from with both of our curriculum directors. Goal number four, Molly and Casey are currently on the road to the California Labor Management Initiative Conference. It's being held in Vallejo, and they'll return tomorrow evening. We also had our monthly meetings with GSCFT and SCCCE in this last week, talking about needs and concerns and collaboration as we move forward. And goal number five, bond oversight committee met last night and reviewed the unaudited actuals of our 2017-18 bond expenditures. Great group of folks. And goal number six, we're in the process of planning a Santa Cruz City Schools Santa Cruz Education Foundation night at the Santa Cruz Warriors on November 30th to benefit our libraries. We'll get more information out in the next week or so. A portion of each ticket sale will go to our the SCEF fund for our school libraries. I gave a tour to Mayor Terrazas and Cesar Levante Councilman Luca on Monday at Bayview and Santa Cruz High School. Councilman Luca is the youngest elected council person in his community, and he's very excited to kind of re-energize the sister city collaborations between schools in his community and our community. I gave a tour for one of our Rotary directors, the Santa Cruz Rotary Director for a Vocational Service, of the CTE classes at Harbor High School. We're going to be scheduling a visit to the Santa Cruz High and Soquel High School CTE classes as well. He's looking at how Rotarians can potentially support our students with career experiences or mock interviews or serving on our Bite of Reality program moving forward. I had a meeting with Chief Mills and Deputy Chief Martinez with Dorothy and Greg a week ago just to introduce the Chief and Deputy Chief to our new Ed Services team. I talked a little bit about the strengths of our collaboration. What do we need to work on together? We talked about both of our organizations' work on threat assessment and how that works together and how we work together. Also, we had the Harbor High School 50th celebration this last Friday, and It was a wonderful celebration. Many of you were able to be there. Great to see so many of the first or the original faculty there, and a lot of excited staff and students. And I was talking to Principal Brent Klein, and Santa Cruz High is looking at 125 years here to celebrate soon as well. So we will continue to have anniversary celebrations as we move forward and celebrating the rich history of our schools. And that is it for my presentation.
Okay. We have no students this evening, so board members.
I would like to say that Mel Martinez is not someone I knew well, but he did die last week. Mm-hmm. And, he will be missed. And I'd like to say that. So, there you
go. Just briefly to let the board and the superintendent know, last week I visited Pacific Elementary up in Davenport and Bonnie Doon, and just trying to get a better sense of our component districts since I'm new to the board. So I haven't in the past visited those schools and those districts, so to speak, one school districts, obviously. And then tomorrow I have the privilege of visiting Happy Valley and Mountain. And all the conversations I had so far, I must say, I would applaud the articulation, both on the superintendent's level, thank you for that, mm-hmm. and with the middle school staffs. So very positive comments and rich experience for me personally to mm-hmm. see those wonderful schools. Thank you.
Enjoyed the Harbor High celebration. Came a little late, so didn't get to hear the speeches. My husband had pointed out, and Principal Ranieri had shown us, we were incredibly impressed with the students doing the album covers, which we thought they had superimposed themselves, but they copied. And so to see the artistic value and the enjoyment behind that was fun. And really just the students themselves, we were down at the football field, the one that they're not allowed to touch yet, but they were all excited about. So that was really a very nice thing to see. And then followed up going to Scotts Valley for the Scotts Valley Soquel High game, where in the stands there were people who were Harbor alums with grandchildren and family at one of the two schools. So it was pretty exciting. Thanks.
I have no report today.
Okay. Well, I also enjoyed the Harbor 50th anniversary. Impressed by the number of alumni that came from all over the place. I spoke to people who came from Nevada and all over the state to be there for this occasion. And also impressed by the number of faculty that were there. The original faculty was... They, too, were very interesting to talk to. I went to the Delta Open House, and my student guide was talking to me about the cohort of Delta students. 15 Delta students are taking an English 500 class, and she was saying how she has anxieties, but this has enabled her to participate in a college class. So for her, it's been very positive, and I'm anxious to see what the success rate is in the class. And the open house was attended by many families and, of course, students. So. Right, our next item is approval of the minutes.
Move for adoption.
Okay, Cindy.
Second.
And Sheila.
Thank you.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? So, okay, we have our consent agenda now. Are there items that people would like to have that you have questions about or would like pulled? Jeremy?
Just a series of brief questions.
Okay.
Should I just go through them or give you the list?
Well, is there anybody else that has questions?
I want to hear Jeremy's.
Okay, go ahead, Jeremy.
All right, well, beginning with 8.1.3, mm-hmm. There's a purchase order on Harbor High, Belle Eye Architectural, $579,000. Project Amendment Architect, PSA Films, Reimbursement and Construction Management Bond, Measure A. I just wanted to know what that $579,000 was for.
Top of my head, it would be one of two things, either the food project or the field project.
Fair enough. I'm beginning to wrap my head around the fact that of our $208 million bond, approximately $21 million, being 10% of that is going to go to architects' fees. And I keep wanting to say no, but I just wanted to point that out. And I'm not saying, there you go. Okay? Then out-of-state travel, special education, 8.1.10. Usually there's a number associated with things, but when I see the fiscal impact, total expenses associated with this trip will be paid for out of special ed administrative funds. Any guess?
So, 500 or so?
I don't know exactly what their what their costs are going to be.
Aren't we supposed to have a number before we say yes? Not that I won't say yes, just in general.
We usually have a not to exceed, and I'm sorry I missed that.
Okay, but if you had to guess, and I won't hold you to it, or is that?
I know that it's going to be a few thousand dollars because they're visiting four different schools in different parts of the state, and they're going to drive. So they're flying in one place. They're going to drive and visit, and then. Dorothy, do you want to add to that?
No, yeah, we apologize. That was an oversight on our part. But yeah, they're going to Utah, and so we'll get the cost as soon as we can on that.
Okay.
And estimate the cost.
All right. But a couple thousand. Okay.
That's probably a good figure. 8.3.2
and 8.3.3, we've got a roofing question. Hallelujah. I'm sorry. 8.1.9, of course. I'm trying to be brief. When I look at our interest rates that we receive, we're now up to 1.456. Is there any way we have any influence on how they invest this money? Because they're not earning us a lot of money.
From the general fund, Jeremy, basically no. And you have options. If you have donations, you can invest. The board can adopt a resolution to invest funds in alternate investments other than the county treasury. But for these types of dollars,
it just doesn't seem to me we're making a lot of money on these investments.
You're not making a lot of money.
I mean, okay. All right. I'm not going to go to Las Vegas and put it all on red or black. All right. Okay. No control of investment portfolio. Okay. Then we go to the roofing, 8.3.2 and 8.3.3. Essentially, when it's $2 million for a roof. Trevor?
As a true roof.
Yeah, I know. $1 million per roof?
Very large roofs, yes. A lot of this is the tile roof. It's about 80% tile.
Tile. Mm-hmm.
Concrete, that beautiful red clay historic tile.
Okay. And that's?
A lot more expensive than any other roof.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then finally, 8.3.4, approve the amendment to Bel Eye Architectural Group Agreement, and that is for the, it's an architect fee. Just walk me through that one.
So originally, the contract for that one only encompassed the music area and the NPR, and we've expanded it now to create a larger project. So it's the music, the NPR, some science, and general ed classrooms as a singular project.
And if you would allow me one follow-up question, if that's okay, mm-hmm. to Trevor. So the way it works is that we have in our head approximately what something will cost, and then the architect fee is about 10% of that, and then we pay that fee, and then we then go bid it after we have that architect planning.
Yes.
So like with the Harbor High Pool, there's an element of... It's a negotiated element of trust, I guess I would put it.
Yes.
Okay. I just am getting a real education. I mean that in a positive way. It's kind of interesting. Okay. In other words, this 447 represents one-tenth, perhaps, of a project that will run around $5 million.
Right. That's the rule of thumb we're using right now to establish the kind of the estimated fees. There is a fee structure in place that is on a sliding scale, so the bigger the project gets, the smaller percentage we pay. And then once it's bid and we have hard numbers, then we know what the real cost is, then the fee is adjusted to meet that real cost.
Interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Are those all of the of your questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for anybody?
Actually, Jeremy got all of mine but one. This is a curiosity question of 8.2.2 and 8.2.3. These academy expenses for special ed, are they mostly, Chris, for... they came to us with IEPs where this was ongoing?
So the residential placements. Some of them were we inherited from other districts.
Two of them we did. Two out of the five.
Two of them were
from feeder districts.
Yeah.
Where it
okay.
was in the IEP.
Okay, that's just what I wanted to know. But sometimes they could be the ones that we've decided.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay. Any comments from the public? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. We have received a generous donation of $3,420 to be applied to the Kids Explore After School program from Santa Cruz Ed Foundation. It's for the 2018-19 school year. Okay, the rest of it is not needed to be said. So thank you very much to the Ed Foundation. There's a whole lot of information we don't need to know.
And now we need the motion.
Move adoption.
Okay, thank you. Cindy?
And I'm sorry, do you want a second?
We don't have a second.
Oh, sorry.
Second. Either Dee Dee or Sheila.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, it's roll call. Jeremy?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
Madam President, may I ask the Secretary, for some reason my board pad has gone into some spinning cycle. Do you have a hard copy of, and I will watch from the, but I was having a hard time. I might even want to guess.
Something.
Like, well, okay, and I've gone, turned it off, put it online, changed. I'm just destined for it tonight.
I had one follow-up question for Trevor. Is it appropriate for me to ask that?
We've already approved, but go ahead. If you're
What's the lifespan of these tiles that are about $1 million per room?
They're long.
If we can keep the neighborhood kids off them, they could last up to 80, 90, 100 years.
And are they the tiles that are on the roofs about that old right now?
Thank you.
Gulch is very close to that age. Mission Hill, I think, at some point in time in the 40s or 50s, may have had a roof replacement because the style of the tile is a little bit different, but we don't know that for sure. The biggest damage really came from where the underlayment of the tile roofs failed. So the new tile was not only a brand new, hopefully slightly longer lasting tile, but the underlayment is significantly higher grade.
Okay, report of closed session.
The Board of Education did not take action on certificate, classified management leaves, retirements, resignations, and appointments. Mr. Gaffney did not have any information to report to the Board of Education regarding public employee discipline, dismissal, release complaints. The Board of Education heard an update from and provided direction to Mr. Gaffney regarding negotiations with the GSCFT for 2018-19. The Board of Education heard an update from and provided direction to Mr. Gaffney regarding negotiations with the SCCCE for 2018-19. And the Board of Education heard an update from and provided direction to Mr. Gaffney regarding property negotiations at 133 Mission Street, Santa Cruz, California.
Thank you. Okay, we're moving on to items be transacted, discussed, we have a staff report on summer professional development.
Yes, we have our directors, Julia Hodges and Marianne Robb, who will be presenting this evening.
All of the things that were happening and providing opportunities and funding teachers to go to do that. Some of the offerings were put on by the district. We put on several professional developments. Some were put on the county office right here. Some were put on by professional developers such as West Ed. We had two well-attended trainings on West Ed, English Learning and Math, which we'll see in a minute. Some were put on by regional organizations such as SDMI, Monterey Bay, Math, or anyway. So, and we want to make sure that all of our offerings, though, align to our four strategic focus areas. So, and we've had some excellent trainings in science, some just first-class training you see from the picture here. So our strategic focus areas are academic literacy, mathematics, English learner progress, and school connectedness. And many of them did touch on two or even three, if not all, of the areas. So we're really proud to be able to do that. Great participation.
Yeah, I just want to echo that we are very impressed with the number of teachers that participated in professional development this summer. We have, 400-something teachers, and we had just over 100 teachers participate in professional development this summer, which speaks a lot to just their dedication and to wanting to improve their practice. So here is some of the professional development offerings that people attended this summer. You also have more listed in the board cover. Like Marianne said, we really wanted to focus our professional development in our four strategic focus areas. So many of the professional developments that we offered this summer had a relation to integrated ELD, which is one of our focuses, K-12. We talked to you about that last spring. And also mathematics, we had the SBMI summer training, and we had a few different next generation science trainings that were very well attended by K-12 educators. We also had our CPM mathematics training. We're in year three right now with integrated Math 3 CPM at the high school level. So all the teachers that haven't taught Integrated 3 attended CPM training, and then any teachers that were teaching our course 1 or 2 also went to CPM training. So we had about 15 teachers get trained this summer in CPM. And then Stanford was offering a workshop on mindset and math, and it's some really great work, and our middle schools right now are offering a Tier 3 intervention related to what they learned in the Mindset Math Summer Institute that they attended. Also, we have a picture here of our AVID Summer Institute group at Sacramento. AVID Summer Institutes occur all over the United States, and we had a big group go to Sacramento. We had a group go down to San Diego. There's two different ones in San Diego that they attended. So I heard from all, and I was fortunate enough to go to the Sacramento one, that they really enjoyed the training. They felt it was worthwhile, especially in regards to integrating literacy into their classrooms. And we also had a secondary GLAD training. Tracy Ranieri, our principal at Harbor High, brought GLAD to our district and opened up a training to all secondary teachers, and this happened right before we went back to school, and it was a two-day training all focused on integrated ELD and ensuring that we have supports in the classroom for students to be successful in accessing academic language. And we also had multiple counseling trainings.
I just wanted to add the mathematical mindset at Stanford was also attended by an elementary teacher, and we did a week-long summer math camp for our migrant students for the first time piloting that. It's really visual, creative math with a strong mindset focus. Really excellent program. And it was great to see the secondary jump on it. And I want to correct Julia, the GLAAD has been alive and well in our elementary district, but this is the first time we brought it to the secondary district. So it really is excellent. We had teachers from Baby Train. Galt is very heavily invested in Galt. It's great to see it go up the grades. We had our August 13th, we had our district-wide first skill day. Again, all of our skill leaders, a full day of training, about 123 or something like that, comprised of leaders, admin, and our skill team leaders, the department head. And our focus was really twofold for this meeting. One was really strengthening our PLC work and that selective teacher efficacy. We'll get into that in a minute. And again, our district-wide K-12 goal of integrated ELD, that the notion that every teacher is a literacy teacher of their academic language, of their content area, from art to math to music to literacy. So
we really believe strongly in ensuring that we have teacher leaders at every single school that are leading professional development. And so as we began this school year, the skill kickoff day is just, it's a great day to just ground us back in the work that we started and are continuing forward with. So this might look familiar to you. One of our foci for the day was on John Hattie's work reminding teachers about collective teacher efficacy. So we were able to read an article to refresh our memories about the power of collective teacher efficacy. And just to remind you, you'll see there's like that gauge here, and it says that D equals 1.57, and the 1.57 is the effect size, and in 1 year's time, if 0.4 is 1 year's growth, or a student's growth, help me, Marianne.
1 year's growth in 1 year's time, it would have an effect size of 0.4. So if a student makes a year's growth in a year, they have an effect size of about 0.4. Different practices might have a smaller effect size, meaning they're not quite making a year's growth. And then these are research-based practices that accelerate it. So at 1.57, that's almost four times the rate of growth. So that's almost 4 years of growth for collective teacher advocacy, which is teachers believing that they have the agency and the power to really make a difference for their students.
So going back to this is the number one thing that John Hattie says in the world of education that will have the biggest impact on students if you are doing it well. And so there's been a lot of research about how do you have this 1.57 effect size when you're collaborating in a teacher group. So one of our foci for the year also is on PLCs, and that is one way that we can build our teachers' collective efficacy is through their PLC work. So we are re-engaging in this work and refining our PLC work. And then also we focus on integrated ELD at our skill day. And again, integrated ELD is something that we know that we need to do in all content areas. And here you'll see some of our pictures of the GLAAD training.
Yeah, I just again, having so many teachers participate is amazing. And many of those teachers, out of those over 100 teachers that participated in summer learning, many did 2, 3, 4 trainings. So not only did we get that great representation from a large group, but some of them did, many of them did more than one training. So really a lot of thirst for great training and knowledge out there. It's really exciting.
And I just like to add that the 120 skill leaders that spent 2 days in training, that is a separate number.
Yeah, from that's a separate number.
From the over 100 that participated in those other opportunities.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes.
All right, that concludes our presentation.
Are there questions? Patty. And then Sheila.
Thank you for sharing. One is when we had the CPM, you said that 15 teachers attended. I know that we have all new math teachers at Harbor High. Were they hired in time so that the majority of them could attend?
The majority of them did attend the summer trainings, and you'll be happy to know that throughout the school year there's going to be 5 more trainings that they participate in. They also participate in coaching cycles through the CPM trainers. They come to our schools and work with teachers, observe a lesson, and debrief, so that they're all part of that. There were a couple who were still under contract that couldn't attend the first couple days, but overall, most were able to attend.
And there's further availability. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Sheila.
So I just would like you to satisfy my curiosity about when I saw, it was really great to see all the professional trainings that teachers were doing. I was trying to picture how that goes with a kind of a cross schools similarity, to have a better word, of, you know, what you're presenting, what you're teaching. And I'm assuming that we want to have different ways coming in. We want teachers who are going and getting excited about different and new ideas. But how does that work when either, A, you find one program that seems to work really well for a particular school, and perhaps you want to move it along to other schools, or B, the ideas and the actual program may be very exciting and helpful, but doesn't fit that well with what our district does. So I was wondering if you could give me a 1-2 minute description of how when we have these people go, how we see it spread, or what we do when it doesn't spread well.
Well, I'll start and I'll pass. And I think that, you know, like we said at the beginning, we wanted to make sure that everything is aligned to one of our strategic focus areas, so that we have a clear district focus. And it might look different at different schools, but part of our task is to go out and get new learning and then bring it back and see how it put into action. And it may not fly, but we want to know, you know, what's working, how's it working, how are we measuring it, all those things are that we this is also an experiment. I believe very much in iteration and exploration. And with a good professional training, you come back and you get really fired up about something and try it. We had, and I'm sorry I didn't call it out, we had 5 teachers go all the way to New York to give training at Teachers College this year, and they came back absolutely fired up and putting it into action. So there's a lot of work towards implementation. It's one thing to get trained, and then the next step is implementation, and we'll see what is working. We really are excited about doing that, and it's great that we have these different things going on, because I think often in education it's not a one-size-fits-all, and so if we wait and wait and wait, and then, okay, now we're all doing this, we might miss some opportunities. So this really was, and it really was our teacher leaders going out with, you know, tied together by our district focus, really going out and seeing
Which was what I was hoping you were going to say, because I think that you're exactly right about being able to bring in fresh, new ideas.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if what made me think of it was the reading workshop in New York, because I'd heard about that before, and I was really happy to hear that the teacher I talked to was so enthusiastic about it. Do you just let natural life spread that to other people, or do you actually, when something seems to really have hit home, get it out to the other schools?
We are, for example, to talk about the literacy programs, we're looking at several programs right now, and we have teachers doing the work, implementing these programs, because again, there's the choosing part, and then there's the implementation, and they're working extremely hard to implement and really teach that way, because in many cases it's a big shift. So time will tell, and we have a task force, we have a committee working together to get information, see what the best fit is for our district. You know, we are a unique district, and who knows better than the teachers of all the resources that we have and what good program. You know, is it going to be this kind of program? Is it going to be this kind of program? How will this fit into what we're already doing? We've moved forward with some curricular choices, and again, I'm speaking about elementary for example, in our science, looking to adopt the FOSS kits or renewing the FOSS kits with Common Core Alliance FOSS kits, how would that fit with our literacy program? And how do we incorporate all these wonderful things we did? We certainly don't want to shove everything aside and, okay, we're all doing this now.
Right.
So, again, I think the teachers are the best judges of that. And so we have a district leadership team of over 20 teachers who are getting input from all that, and we have pilots going on in all the schools. So it's a pretty exciting time. It's kind of we'll get together and we'll just basically arm ourselves and see who wins. But no, it's a good creative process right now.
Thanks, and yeah, thanks for how clear you make it when you present.
Dee Dee, your turn.
It's heartening to see so much of the integrated ELD embedded in the PD that you were offering the teachers this summer, especially in the context of the CASP data that we see about Everett English learners. My question is, the numbers are impressive in terms of the total quantity of teachers that are participating, but do you have a sense of how many participated at the elementary level versus the secondary level, and were there any particular subject area teachers that were represented more than other subject areas?
We could certainly, yeah, I mean, we could get you those numbers. I don't have them on the top of my head. We had a, yeah.
No, you go ahead. I know in secondary, math was a big focus. This summer, not only did we have CPM training, but we had a task force of teachers get together and do priority standards work. So they went through course one, course two, and started to do course three and determine what the priority standards are. And they took that and then compared it to their scope and sequence. So I know math teachers, and also in middle school, there was a lot of math work done, and our coordinators, or our RTI coordinators in secondary, are really coordinating those math efforts so that even if there was not someone at the training, they're still ensuring that their PLCs are working on what was learned and it's being brought back to the whole team. So I would say math is very coordinated, and we have a very strategic plan for that at secondary. And then also science teachers were represented. I mean, elementary does everything, but we have a very coordinated effort right now with science as well. Heather Murphy meets with all of our science leads and ensures that they are all either attending trainings or have access to trainings, and then they bring that back to their PLC work also as a department lead. So I would say science and math right now are well represented. Like I said, we just have to look at the numbers. I think, I just have to do the count. We did, last year we did a series of math professional development 3 days during the school year in elementary. So we were not so represented in the summer trainings in elementary math, certainly, but we are going out better represented in literacy and science. And like she said, elementary teachers teach everything. So any of our teachers went to science, they went to math, they went to a literacy training, and yeah, at the secondary literacy trainings, it was really great to see teachers from all content areas. It wasn't just heavily English teachers like you might think, but there are really teachers, there are PE teachers, health teachers. I mean, we had a wide variety of subject areas represented.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Good point, Cindy.
Thanks for a very helpful report. Busy summer, very productive, I trust. My question is a bit of a thinking out loud one, so if you don't have an answer, that's fine. But I wanted to address the collective teacher efficacy, and if the ideal, if you will, based on the research, would be that 1.57 efficacy difference, which would give multiple years growth in 1 year. And what I heard you say was, of course, that 1.57 would reflect professional learning communities that are thriving, that are really working, and that the collaboration is done very, very well. Mm-hmm. So ideally, if that were happening, we would see growth beyond what we're going to see in the next report.
Yeah.
So how do we know, and who helps us discover if we're doing this collaboration work well, and how can that be improved? Because if we are going to get to the accelerated learning outcome, then based on the theory we're following, we need this collective teacher action. Mm-hmm. Do you have any reflection on that?
Definitely. definitely, which is why we are refocusing on PLCs this school year. When we met with Skill in August, one of the questions, well, we read several readings on collective teacher advocacy and what needs to be in place to have an effective PLC. And then we had Skill leaders collaborate amongst themselves on what are the things that are preventing them, what are the barriers that are preventing them from meeting those ideals. And we saw some trends in what they said. One of the major things that they said is time. Mm-hmm. Many PLCs met just once a month, maybe twice a month. Mm-hmm. And so the research says you need to meet every 7 to 14 days in order to really have a big effect on, a big impact on student learning. And so I know as a result of some of this reading that we've done, many principals have restructured the amount of time that they're giving to PLC work so that there's actually just the time there for teachers to engage in that. Another high trend that we saw in the feedback from teacher leaders was that they felt like they didn't have training in facilitation and how to facilitate a PLC. And it kind of was twofold. There's the actual, like, how do I lead a discussion when there's disagreement or when there's a feeling, a lack of safety or whatever. And so we haven't done PLC facilitation training or training for teacher leaders with that in mind until our Skill Day. We did have a breakout session that was all about teacher facilitation. And the other component of teacher facilitation is we haven't, as a district, adopted any sort of protocol to help facilitate PLC work in looking at student work and looking at standards and breaking down standards. So there's a lack of just structure and protocol right now in our PLCs. So these were our major findings, and we knew that going in. We offered breakout sessions on PLC protocols on this day, too. And as a result of this work, I've gone to De La Viega, and I'm working with both middle school Skill teams and providing training for them on facilitation and on using protocols in their PLCs. But I also have a training I'm doing with SoCal High Skill teams. So we're trying to get them the training that they need so that they feel confident in their skills and ability to lead their PLCs.
Thank you. Jeremy?
Yeah. I really want to thank Cynthia for opening that door in a very respectful and thoughtful manner. And I'm going to continue to speak to that. I mean, so here we see collective teacher efficacy. This is Hattie's work, 1.57 fluid, and the ideal translate into 4 years worth of growth. And yet, when we look at standardized test scores, which we will do momentarily, I'll just quoting from you, overall, comma, scores are relatively flat, quote unquote. So there's a disconnect at this point that is, it's not impolite or improper to point it out. There's a disconnect between what we seem to know, what the research tells us, and what perhaps some teachers get, and I'm not implying that others don't, and where we're at in terms of institutionalizing or creating protocols for these wonderful collective teacher efficacy results to take place, if you will. So what I'm looking for, and tell me, I'm asking my fellow school board members if this is too pie in the sky or too pushy or whatever. What I think I'm looking for is a executive summary of some sort of master plan. How's that for teacher talk? That you could come back to us and say, here's a very clear path about how we're going to get there. If, in fact, we know that teachers then have to meet, let's just say, every other week, forgive me for being long-winded, to do this, how do we set that up? I mean, and how much is it going to cost, and what do we have to sacrifice to allow that to happen, and where are the models in our district and in other districts as the liaison to the science leads? I think that might be a potential model, but I just throw that out as an aside. And when do we have the plan so that we can move in this direction? Because we've been sort of talking around this for a while, and if we're sure about this now, then would it be appropriate, fellow school board members, to ask our two directors of curriculum, elementary and secondary, to come back to us at a certain time, 3 months, 6 months, and say, here's the plan, here's really how we're going to get there, and we're committing to this. It might involve talking to the unions, I don't know, because there might be some money involved, and there may, but we seem to be getting closer to knowing what we need to do. So how then, what is the next step to institutionalize that, to do that?
So can I just speak to that?
So a lot to put on the table, and thank you so much for listening.
Can I speak to that?
Please.
I want to give also some more context in history. In 2010, when we started SKILL, we didn't have collaboration time at all in our high schools. And it's evolved slowly. But we've gone from zero to two of our high schools have collaboration time once a week. It's very short. It is very short, and they need more time. But I want to give a scope of over the last 8 years. There, I know it's slow, but there's been a lot of movement in this, and there was a lot of initial training in facilitation and protocols. And what we saw was we need to reboot that. And that's what we did this year because we've had turnover in who our SKILL leaders are. So in the first, in 2010, 2011, 2012, we did a lot of training on that, and we recognized that needs to be ongoing. And that's kind of where we are in terms of moving forward with that. And we could look at, as we get to our last agenda item tonight, we'd like to have them come back and present on what we're doing, with PLCs and where we are in kind of our reboot this year and where we see the needs and next steps. We could talk about that as we talk about future agenda items. Would that feel comfortable to you, Jeremy? Would that meet the need that you're expressing?
You're asking me that question.
Mm-hmm.
The role of the board, other than our fiduciary responsibility, is to set direction and policy. And I'm thinking that if we're certain about collecting teacher efficacy as being the number one thing we're looking for to move the dial,
mm-hmm.
and also we have data that tells us that overall our scores are flat.
Mm-hmm.
So we have it's okay to say it. We haven't moved that dial.
We haven't moved the dial on our standardized test, for
we
sure.
We really haven't.
We've moved it in some other places, but definitely not our standardized test.
Then the role of the board, it would seem to me logically,
mm-hmm.
would be to be given direction from experts and then do some negotiations and talking and public talking as to what good policy around this area might look like. And if in fact, again, I'm just thinking out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question, the short answer is yes. But if in fact teachers really need 30 to 45 minutes, perhaps even an hour, every other week with each other to work in groups and collaborate on various things to move that dial, then our job would be to somehow figure out what policies we have to put in place so that they can get that.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean, again, thinking out loud,
so, and I'm
making some very hard choices or being given the mm-hmm. options of some very hard choices.
And in some cases, it would be negotiated because it might be a change in working conditions.
I understand that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be helpful to know how much PLC time is at each school and at each grade span?
It would be, and for me it would also be helpful to know who, forgive the word, controls the what that PLC time will be.
Right.
Because if we're looking at collective teacher efficacy, one of the crucial components would be teacher buy-in. And so there would, how is that PLC time determined? Lots of questions here, and no judgments, just sort of hard thinking out loud.
So why don't we talk about like a future agenda item at that last item.
Yeah. Or am I off in left field? Does that make sense?
No, not at all.
Let's move it to the last item, okay?
Notice I say left field, not right field. Political illusion.
We have a lot of lights on. So,
okay, thank you.
Patty.
So thank you, Cindy and Jeremy. You've moved into the waters I wanted to talk about. And I just want to try to grasp what I think that Jeremy's asking for. And what I'm hearing is that, Chris, you're saying that we've had a lot of movement. So in the last 8 years that we've talked about, we haven't been able to develop a system that is actually working. So I'm looking to think of a system that comes forward. I know that they will be different along different sites, different levels for different needs. They will probably need different support that the board will work through and how we get there. But, you know, when point four of this collective efficacy should be moving year to year, we would be picking up three. So in 2 years, a student would have the 2 years that they've had school and six more years of education that they should be able to reflect out that would show up in any of our standard test
scores.
That's
the ideal.
Yes, I'm just reiterating this. I know that we continually talk about our challenged populations, whatever they may be, but I had a conversation with my son, who's always the one who seems to help keep me grounded around these matters, and he said, you know, it's interesting. We need to really maybe take a step back and understand that every district, every student, every state has a population of needs, whatever it is. What is it that's keeping us from moving along in that manner? And I just want to float that out there along with the systems, because when we talk about the movement, we haven't seen the results in the 8 years you've been talking about. And that is difficult as a board member because we set the direction. So I feel that we're just treading. We have some hard work to do up here.
So just to honor the teachers' work, I do want to say we aren't seeing the results in CASP. We are seeing the results of the kids passing algebra.
No, I'm not. Please do not internalize that as not believing in the work. What I'm seeing is that we don't have systems that are working for us. So we're using a lot of energy in a lot of little areas that are garnering not the results that we're looking to be. So let's build some systems here.
If I can take that one a little bit off of that one. We last year we were trained in multi-tiered systems of support, and out of that work we have identified these four focus areas. And that work, we're working very hard to develop that system, you know, and it really ties together everything that we've been talking about tonight, like, you know, oh, we're doing this, and now we're doing this. No, we need to focus. We need to have metrics attached to each of these areas, and we need to do the work, and we need to really do the work. We need to develop our PLCs. Out of that MTSS work, we've identified a tier one practice at all levels that we're going to be focusing on. Out of that came our focus on integrated ELD. We're visiting other districts to see what they're doing, and we're moving in that direction. A couple of the districts that we visited, Live Oak and San Luis Coastal, that we have seen, of course, are many years into this work. So we are starting from where we're starting from, and we cannot go directly to where they are overnight. We have to build those relationships. We've made some adjustments. Every year we look at our LCAP and we make adjustments. What's working? What do we need to enhance? And we continue to develop the system. But I totally understand what you're saying, and I just want to say that is our framework of a multi-tiered system of support. What are we doing in the classroom to support children? There's a lot of education is complicated. I don't need to say it. One of the things we're working very hard on, and Helene's teaching readers workshop, and all this stuff is going on about literacy, because a really important part of any system is having a guaranteed and viable curriculum that is articulated and shared throughout the district. So that is our goal. We're not going to keep doing reading this way and that way. This is our work to kind of figure out what is that system going to be in elementary literacy, and that is the water we're swimming in right now. So I totally hear what you're saying. Another thing I'm very excited about, and we're looking to neighboring districts, you know, we rolled out MAP last year, and it was hard. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't smooth. But MAP is pretty cool, and I'm really getting excited about it. I can't wait to really put the data in teachers' hands so they have real-time data of how they're doing, at least, you know, progress monitoring throughout the year. The alignment between MAP and CASP was pretty spot on. And so it's like, oh, great, because a lot of times we don't know until we get the autopsy at the end of the year how we're doing on CASP scores. So having that power to look at those scores three times a year and adjust our teaching, because MAP leads directly to a learning continuum that you could say, oh, okay, well, Jeremy needs a little help in this strand. Let's get him that help and so he can move on. Just yesterday, I was here at a training of all the neighboring counties around that are using MAP. And I have to say, Pajaro is doing some stuff with MAP that knocked my socks off about student goal setting and really sharing the information with the students. And the students are totally bought in, you know. Like, even my own son came home the other day with, like, Mom, you know, he had the number 252 written on his arm. This is what I got in MAP. Tell me what it means, you know. They are bought into knowing that they're learning, and that they've been going around, they've been doing social-emotional work and actually asking students, how do you know when you're learning? And they're giving the information to the kids, and the kids are really enjoying it. They've made amazing. And I can't wait to see their CAS scores, because they're 3 years into MAP. And they, last year, they were just, oh my goodness, it's flat. We did flat, flat, flat. And I think we're going to see a little leap there, I'm thinking. So they're doing some really exciting things, and we're learning from them as well. Anyway, I can go on and on, but all those things that we are doing, that we're proposing, that we're, the way we spend our money, whatever we're doing, is exactly part of that system. We're going to try to eliminate those random arrows and say, you know, that's a really cool thing, but right now we need to do this. And that's what we're trying very hard to do. Is that
helps. It was just more so for me to externalize the frustration of the next report and being on the board with the ultimate goal, but I really like hearing your comparison to the students at Pajaro, because really for a lifelong learner, we want them to be engaged and involved in their own, and in order for them to grow, they have to know where they stand, and there's no judgment in that. I think people think that test scores are a judgment or something negative, but I can't get better until I know where I start.
Yeah.
And moving forward. And it doesn't matter where I start. It's just the fact that I'd like to be motivated to start. So it helps. So those are some really great tools to hear. And I've been long-winded. Thank you.
We have a number of lights on. So Sheila, then Dee Dee, and then Dorothy. Okay.
Well, I just want to add to this conversation one comment that I didn't put the light on for, but I think that Chris's remark got passed over really quickly. Although I think that test scores are important and we have to look at them because that's what the students are going to have in the future, I think that whether we're getting kids more excited, more passing algebra more, that one was like good 10 years of hitting our heads on the wall. And beginning to, when I have students talk to me about being in high school and having these conversations with their small groups and not being able to figure out the solution to something, then that to me is something that is more important to me to measure, although certainly I think the test scores have to be there. And we may see movement. I think what you're saying is we're seeing movement in that, which we hope will lead to movement in test scores, because that's how I would think it would go. But I thought that I agreed with Jeremy, and thank you, Jeremy, for bringing it up, and Cindy. But I also thought that, at least, I don't know if Jeremy was asking this, but if he wasn't, I'm going to. I would like us not to just be sitting here going, yeah, sure, good, yay, you're doing a good job. If what's happening is you're looking and saying, if we could only have enough funds to have more PLC time. If we could only arrange our schooling in a way that allowed this to flow better, mm-hmm. that I would like to, I'd like the information as to how much you have to spend now to do what mm-hmm. you do, and how much of that is what you would ideally like to do. And I would like to know what kinds of things, I'm sure you've talked to your superintendent, assistant superintendent about this, but I also would like to know it. I mean, I think all of us here want to kind of know what we have to be thinking about to help support this happening. And it, maybe we can't do it all at once, but over time, I do much better sitting here when I can say, wow, I didn't realize these people didn't have this tool. And maybe there's a way that I can start to focus on thinking about how that tool is going to come in. So I think that's part of what Jeremy was saying too. And so if you're giving us information, that's some of the information I'd like to have. Thanks.
I appreciate the comments from my colleagues on the board, and the concept of collective teacher efficacy is very thought-provoking, and I think we have high hopes for it as a magic bullet that's going to move the needle, so to speak. And I would just like to point out that collective teacher efficacy is an outcome of what professional development, teacher supports, we offer, and PLCs. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really the magic bullet. The magic bullet is what we do to get to that collective efficacy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where our questions are centered around, is how do we get there? How do we leverage these PD offerings that are wonderful to get there? And so my question is, that's what's my comment, my question is, to what extent do you two expect to see elements of those trainings embedded in the PLCs that the teachers are going to engage in?
The administrators are side by side with their teachers in the PLCs, and how it looks out. Like the August 13th day that we did collectively was followed by another skill day back at the site. So elementary, secondary, all sites then have a second skill day, and then out of that day develop their professional development plans and how they're going to do that, and how, what are they going to do this year. Every year we write the school plan and the professional development plans along with that. So that is their plan for addressing the needs of their school for this year, within their budget and everything else. So that's how that manifests out. It's constant work and having that common vision at a school and moving forward together is really important. And identifying, you know, where are we going? Like several of you have said it in many ways. I like to use the analogy, make a map. We're here, we want to go there. What if we're going to have different outcomes on tests? What kinds of things do children, in fact, in our PD plans, we used a logic model this year. You know, if we want to see this happening in the classroom, what do teachers need to learn to have these behaviors and move backwards, not from them? And so I'll let Julia finish that question.
So part of that to me is also time. You need to have sustained focus and training on one particular topic. And when you do offer summer offerings, it's optional, right? So it's not a systematic way of training your teachers. Having the one PD day for skill is a systematic way. Skill leaders know that day is coming. They know being a part of skill means they attend that day, of getting all of our leaders trained. Having that one PD day before school starts is one step towards having a systematic way of getting teachers, PD, all teachers, where it's not a summer training where, I mean, I have little kids. I know it'd be hard personally for me sometimes to do a summer training. I know a lot of our teachers have many different obligations that they might want to go to a training but just can't in the summer. Research, I read a lot. Research does say that you need at least 14 hours before you're going of training before you're going to see any sort of shift in instructional practice and shift on an impact on learning. So 14 hours, if you have I mean, that's something we've been talking about with Cabinet, too, is how often do our teachers actually get PD? Do they get 1 hour once a month during the school year? That's nowhere near 14 hours. And is it always focused on the same topic? So these are things that we're talking about.
And as we do PD, we're constantly seeking feedback. How do we make it better? One of the feedbacks that we got from, we had an August 20th day, we had an elementary PD day, and it was like teachers were engaged, they were really appreciative of the work, they had many positive things to say, but it was like, do we have to do this a day before school starts? I mean, school was starting in 48 hours after this day, and that was like, it's so hard, you know, can we, so let's go to the negotiating table. Let's talk about this. Could we put that during the school year? Because they do need time when they're fresh. I know that many other districts in our area have days throughout the year where, okay, we're all going to focus on this, and we'll follow it up with future trainings. But
Dorothy.
Excuse me. So I think we're all saying very similar things. I don't want to belabor the point here, but one of the quotes that we used when we spoke to our teachers and teacher leaders was in regards to data, because I was really struck with the effort to share data that can be difficult for teachers because we see students maybe not making the progress that we want them to make. And the quote was, if you're not looking at data, you're either guessing or you're wrong. And I am really struck, and I've had the privilege of coming in from out of the district, and what I was really struck by when I got here was that there are these four focus areas that came out of the MTSS retreat that has driven the work and the planning of the district thus far that I have seen in my short tenure here. And I was especially pleased to see that everything is anchored in those four standards, and that when you're looking at what do we take off the table, we have to provide more time, a viable, guaranteed curriculum for students, which, by the way, we're looking at the textbooks as a means to an end, right? It's all about the standards and the pedagogy and best instructional practices, but it's really making sure that we strategically abandon those things that distract us from what we want to achieve and make sure that we stay focused on those four areas. So just as someone coming in from out of the district, I can say with confidence that I really see systems beginning to take shape and happening, and that I've been extremely impressed by our directors and the work that they've done in those areas. And I think we're really going to see the impact, especially because we're also working on a data system, which includes MAP, which will be able to give us interim assessment data over time about how our students are doing. So I just wanted to just give that input. I've come into this in the 11th hour, but I do see some great strides in systems and those efforts. So thank you.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I just want to throw out a few numbers. You say 14 hours is minimum. You also say what's that?
88 is ideal.
88. eight a month. Right. Yeah.
But
you, all, okay.
You also say 7 to 14 days a week. What I would like, speaking personally, I don't know if it's the collective will of the board. What I need to hear from you when you have time to present it at a later date is what a schedule would look like in which you, let's say I'm coming up with 18 to 20 meetings a year every other week, an hour each time, there's your 18 to 20 hours. And what that would look like, what would need to be negotiated to get there. If, in fact, we're committed to that, if we know the data shows us, the studies show us that's where we need to be, then what would a schedule like that look like? Who would be at the table in determining how those hours are spent? What might the focus be? Again, coming back to science, they might be a model because they meet once a month for 2 hours, for example, at least about 20 science teachers. and have been doing so for 3 years. So I sort of the nuts and bolts of that kind of schedule, that would be very helpful. Are we able to do it? I don't know, but at least we would have such a thing. Mm-hmm. That would be really, really helpful to me. Mm-hmm. No guarantees, but does that sound logical?
Yeah, and one of the things that we actually have discussed is getting a baseline of what actually is going on at the sites because you hear one thing, what's the reality?
Right.
Or maybe there's more going on at certain sites that we're not aware of. So we are definitely, that is something that we plan to do for our baseline.
There's
and then going from there.
One of the obviously for science in his last year, and we have to thank him a great deal. Michael has ponied up $420,000 for the county. And let's say our share of it is more than just 10% for 10 districts. Let's say our share of it is $30,000 a year. You know, what grants can we go after and say, look, we're committed to this. We may not be able to go back to the county, but are there industries we can partner with? Where might we look, not only what do we need, but where might we look outside of our funding sources that we have to gather this? And could you do that while speaking in iambic pentameter?
So I just have one question to add to it, which is, as Jeremy was talking, I was thinking about in my time in the district, how many meetings were there for different groups of people, and how in this process, I would like to have a little of that information too, because there was, I don't know that there is now, but there was then complaints about meetings that teachers did not feel were helpful to them. And certainly as psychologists, we had the interesting experience of never having any professional training that had anything to do with us, but we had to go anyway. So, you know, that's an unusual situation. But in general, I would like to know what kind of, whether we're putting a burden on them that we might have to relieve in some way. So I'm just throwing that question in. Is that, I mean, I don't expect you to know the answer, but like if we decide to get this much and we're committing ourselves to this, is there a relief that we need to offer in terms of other kinds of meetings or other kinds of requirements?
Okay. Well, I know different schools do different things. At Mission Hill, when I was principal, and the principal before me and now Kat is doing this, we didn't do staff meetings. We eliminated staff meetings completely. We did all business through our weekly memo. And so that then we could focus, we'd have 2 PD days a month and 2 PLC days a month. And
that's
middle
what
school
I was thinking.
Is so lucky that we have early release every Wednesday. So it affords us that opportunity. That's not the case for high school, and then elementary has their own language, contract language around what happens on Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Cindy.
Could I make a suggestion?
Sure.
What if we heard the next report mm-hmm. and finish up the meeting?
Yeah.
And then at the end of the meeting, I think we could take some of these collective thoughts and mm-hmm. hand it to the superintendent in terms of mm-hmm. take our
yeah.
input.
Yeah,
and there may be more input by the end of the meeting.
Right.
And come up with an agenda item.
Yeah, that's on the agenda at the end of the meeting. So, yeah. I think it's time
that's
to
good.
Move on. Thank you. And
thank you.
Our next item. And next,
thank
we
you.
Have
keep standing.
Yes, test results.
Before our directors begin, I just wanted to let the board know that the data that you're going to see tonight is based on the preliminary release of CAS, and we just got word today that the final results will be released on October 2nd. So we have a light at the end of the tunnel as far as that's concerned. So. Yes, and while it is preliminary data, we don't anticipate very many changes to this data that you're going to see, if any. All right, so just quick CASP overview and basics about CASP. CASP is our California Assessment of Student Performance and Progress. Smarter Balanced is the company, so you might hear SBAC sometimes. It's the same test if you hear SBAC or CASP. People kind of use those interchangeably. SBAC is the company that creates the test. It's computer-based. It's adaptive, which means the test that I'm taking is not the same as the test that Mary Ann's taking. It adapts to the level. So if you get a question wrong, then it might ease up a little bit in difficulty. And so it kind of adjusts to how you're doing. If you keep answering questions correctly, it gets harder and harder and harder. And you'll see some little students trying very, very hard, and they're reading these really challenging passages because they just keep getting those answers right, and so it keeps getting more difficult. So this test is unique in that way. We give it to students in grades 3 through 8, and then also in grades 11, so just one grade in high school. And then this, designed to gauge students' performance in mathematics and English language arts. There are two major components of the math test and the English language arts test. There's one that it's not multiple choice, it's short response. Some of it is multiple choice, but involves reading selections, writing short responses. And then there's something called the performance task, which students have to read multiple selections if it's the English language arts, and then they write responses, short responses, and then often a longer essay type of response. So these tests are intensive, and they require a lot of focus for our students. The math performance task is similar in the sense that you get a variety of math problems, and then you have to write about the math. You can't just solve the problem. You have to explain and justify your reasoning in a math performance task. And I believe you had some sample problems. I would say that just the mere fact that you have something printed in front of you makes it not adaptive and is not necessarily what you would see. And if you're really interested, they have the practice tests online. So if you Google CASP practice tests, you can go in, you can choose whichever grade level, grades 3 through 8 or 11, and you can take part of the test or just click through and kind of see what the kids get. The practice tests also aren't adaptive, though, so you don't get that feature. All right, we talked about this being preliminary data. So that also means we don't have the state data or our county data yet. That will be something that we will prepare for you and give you after we see it on the 2nd, so that you can see how our district compares to state and county.
So again, this is English Language Arts. Again, this is the spring year here. So this is the first year we gave it, 2014-15, 2015-16, and 2016-17. As this is comparing our local data in blue to county and state, we do not yet have a 2018. We'll have that on Tuesday. So, but you can see that our district compares very favorably to state data as well as our county data. State data in yellow, county data in red. And the next slide, this is English Language Arts, and here is mathematics. Again, we compare favorably. And I think that we all know that, you know, data can hide in that. And until we really disaggregate and look at different subgroups, there's not that sense of urgency. So some of the data we've been looking at over the last year have really unearthed some areas we want to address in a systematic way and an effective way. So that's the last 3 years. Now, because we had a window where we can get our preliminary data, I do have 2017-18 data for our district only. This is all students. It's the same data we were seeing before, but this time it's by grade level. If you follow a grade level across, you'll see how third graders here did in 14-15, 15-16, 16-17, and 17-18. Now, if you follow the shades, you will see how these third graders did in third grade, those third graders, the same third graders did in fourth grade, same group in fifth grade, and the same group in sixth grade. So the color bands show a cohort over time. Again, it's not 100%. You know, kids come and go. But you know, you would be counting all the third graders this year, all the fourth graders, that when they begin, so I don't know the percentage, I would say probably 98% of them are continuing, 95 to 98% are continuing along the grades.
Yeah, so for example, this fourth grade cohort, it's interesting, started at 53, moved to 64, 62, then 66. So you have some cohorts that are steadily making progress, and then you have some cohorts, let's see, like the sixth grade one, 62, 60, 55, and then they don't take it when they're in ninth grade. So we don't have ninth grade data, but we are going to be able to get our math data. Mm-hmm. So we can continue to see how our students are doing in ninth and tenth grade. We're giving it in English and in math in both ninth and tenth grade classes.
And the 11th grade is great only because it's not a cohort. So these are the 11th grade. Because we don't test in 9th and 10th and 12th, we can't really follow them. So 8th grade is the last time we follow the cohort up. And the next one is math. So yellow is English Language Arts and blue is mathematics. Again, same structure. You can follow the cohort up over time. So this is all our students year to year. The next slide shows our low-income students. So these are sometimes referred to as socioeconomically disadvantaged children, but there are in our LCAP they are called low-income. So again, same structure. You can follow cohorts over time. I mean, this is actually, when you look at the cohort data, you can see this particular fourth grade group really, that's significant, mm-hmm. 24 to 42%.
And that same group just overall was increasing, if you remember, too. Mm-hmm. But it is disconcerting when you see some trends, but then they don't keep repeating themselves from grade level to grade level or from cohort to cohort. So I think that goes back to the systems questions that you were asking. What do we have systematically in place so that we do see that growth from grade level and cohort to cohort?
And same group, same cohort, this is, or same subgroup, low-income students in math. And again, when we looked at our MAP data and how they compared, it was quite similar.
You said within 1%, very close.
It was very close, yeah.
Depending on the grade level, some grade levels were closer than others. English had a higher correlation than MAP too, in general, which is interesting. Maybe ask lots of questions.
And again, as you get, you know, these are children, and you know, this is a one kind of measure. Things happen on a given day as well. I know that in elementary, we gave the MAP test after CAS testing. This year, we're going to try giving it before CAS testing. I mean, kids get tired. I mean, when's the best time to do it? Again, and we'll continue to check in with our partner or our neighboring districts to see what they did. Tomorrow's going back to testing after CAS. So it's part of, it depends on your culture. And as teachers get, you know, get to trust that, you know, once they saw the correlation, it was like, oh, this is really interesting. This could be useful. And until you know that, what does this have to do with my students and their learning? Okay, so I think we're going to get a lot better buy-in this year. And then this is our Everett English Learners. It only goes back 2 years because the state only created this subgroup in 1617. So former and current English learners.
Yeah, so the student reclassified as English proficient in fourth grade but are now taking the test in 11th grade, they'd be here in this number even though they reclassified many years ago. Mm-hmm.
And the same data by now. And again, with our data analysis system, Illuminate, which is now our student information system, we are able to pull this information in and disaggregate the information by whatever group we put together. So I look forward to having more, even more discrete data.
Do you want to talk about strengths? All right, overall, strengths, you saw the first slide. When you're looking at our student body overall and how they're doing on CASP testing, they are doing better than state and county averages. There's a few other bright spots. Seventh grade English language arts as a whole and our low-income seventh grade students have seen steady increases over the past 4 years. Seventh grade traditionally is a really hard year for kids too, so I was happily surprised that they're doing so well on the test. There are some schools that have seen significant growth. Statistically speaking, when you're talking about significant growth, you're talking about 5% difference or more. And so Santa Cruz High, in their overall math score, saw an increase of 6%. And for English Language Arts, they saw an increase of 9%. And I know last year they had a focus on writing in their PLCs, and that was their PD work. I have lots of questions. I'm going to pick Brent's brain on what they feel like attributed to those scores. But on the whole, Santa Cruz High and even their subgroups had the same trajectory, that they increased low income and also their English learners, maybe not as much of an increase, but on the whole, their students are increasing. All right, and then areas for strategic focus. I already mentioned there's no real trends in the data. It depends from cohort to cohort. It depends from grade level to grade level how we're doing. And overall, we're relatively flat. We haven't seen significant, statistically speaking, growth as a district. It doesn't mean there aren't school sites that are experiencing growth or whatnot. But we need to focus on that. We need to refocus on our systems, refocus on what we know works and what has been working in education for a while, and we need to make sure we have those systems in place.
Continued strategic. I mean, that's why we have a English progress strategic focus area, and it's by shining a light on that data and being transparent and saying, ooh, we have some work to do, that we put the focus on there and make that a priority. Yes, they're not the only group that is struggling, but by instituting or putting in place strong systems that support those students, we're going to be lifting all students it's no surprise that the English learner subgroup is very congruent with the low-income students in our system and have many congruencies with our special ed population, and et cetera. Continue to train teachers in evidence-based instructional practices. Teacher clarity is another visible learning effect size. I think it's 0.7 or 0.8, double the rate of your learning when teachers are clear about what students are learning and able to convey that to their students. Where are we going? Where am I now? Where am I going? How do I get there? Those are the big questions. Integrated ELD K-12 with a focus on academic language. We did a two-day training with all administrators, and we're doing that in our professional development throughout the year. It's in everybody's PD plan, so it's pretty exciting to see alignment. We shifted the elementary coaching model, modeled off of Live Oak and San Luis Coastal. Both those districts have full-time coaches, at least one full-time coach at every school. We have shifted our elementary coaching from being content area coaches that serve all the schools to being at two or three schools only. One of our coaches is serving Bayview and Dela Vega, the other is Galt and Westlake and Honor a little bit as well. And so at least because we know the basis of coaching is relationship. It's not about coming in and fixing anything, it's developing relationships, working side by side, and what do you think? It's that collective teacher efficacy again. I will say that San Luis Obispo had an English learner coach as well as an instructional coach at each site. They also had Diablo Canyon in their district for many years, and that they were very open about pointing out, it's like, yeah, we had a lot of property tax for a lot of years, I mean, millions of dollars to do real quality professional development 10 years back. So they had that confusion of property taxes. Provide students with aligned guaranteed curriculum and assessments. What is our instructional program in literacy? How do we know kids are learning? What assessments? Excited about math, like we said. Increase collective teacher efficacy through professional learning, community, PLC facilitation training. We just talked about that. CPM trainings, Twilight Math Series. We have a lot of teachers that go out for extra training in math. And I know our math data are not something. We adopted a new math program in elementary just 2 years ago. And, you know, it's the rigor is up. And now we need to make sure that we're teaching in a way that children are able to access that, bringing language routines into our mathematics instruction. And again, academic literacy in mathematics as well. Train skill leaders to better use math assessments to inform instruction and provide focus. We're having training on October 24th for our skill leaders and provide focused site professional development in math and academic literacy. So we've actually touched on most of these in our conversation, earlier conversation, so it is very connected. That's our best.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Patty?
Thank you. And as you said, we have touched in our earlier presentation. There's just a couple of things that I was thinking about what Ms. Quintus said about the data and how we use it. And one of them, I'm wondering if you can abstract. There's a couple of little questions about how we go about this. So first, it would be helpful to know how many students are in each grade level. So you have a third grade level. Are we 31% of 100 or, you know, 300, whatever that might be? How many of the same students are we testing? Is there a way to abstract that the third graders that we had, say, at one school, may have been a whole different group of fourth graders where we have more of a transient school? So you're testing students that we may not necessarily. I'm just looking for just pieces. It's a little bit deeper, and it may not be able to be easily done, but it may shed some light onto where we vary these variants that take us to nowhere. And then, yeah, so that was, are we testing the same students? When we say the state and versus the county, you know, that's huge. We have districts that are incredibly poor with maybe, that would wish for better numbers. But when we continue to point at San Luis Coastal and Live Oak, can we have a comparison? And also a comparison of size of students. So say they're fourth graders, or, you know, they have 400 fourth graders, we have 400 fourth graders. Theirs were here, and their subsets were here. All that was reported, because we're looking to those districts for their practices. Can we also see what their results might be, and their subgroups giving us a comparison as to why we're saying they're getting these? Maybe their subgroups are not the volumes or whatever it might be, because percentages can be a little bit misleading. If I pass and I'm the only one in the class, that's 100% of the students passing. And I think about that. And then last, I want to point to the Santa Cruz High model. When we talk about math at Santa Cruz High and testing at grade 11, if I understand the schedule, the Excel schedule, if I were a student at Soquel High and I took Math 1, Math 2, and by 11th grade I was in Math 3, I would know those 2.5, 3 years of math to be tested upon. But if I were an 11th grade student at Santa Cruz High, in my first year I've had 2 full years of math, and my second year I've had 2 full years of math, and by that third year I might have 3 years of math. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of math prior to that grade 11 test. And would we want to see even a larger increase in math under a model of that size? It's because it's not fair to you, it's just that's how our district is set up. So when we compare the overall increase, is it really an increase when I've had 5 years of math and maybe a student's only had 2.5?
But they didn't just change their schedule.
Right.
So, like, when you look at their schedule previous, like, the previous years they've had past testing, they've had the same schedule.
That's right.
So you're comparing
going up
the school
compared
to itself
okay.
again and again.
Yeah.
So it is significant, because with the same schedule now, they have increased.
Okay, and so then with that, is their increase carrying our entire 11th grade, meaning if they had a very large 11th grade class, are our other two schools perhaps someplace, you know, completely different? That's just a scheduling piece, something to think about when I'm trying to make a board decision of how we're going to best support in dollars or whatever comes forward, a way to move this. I just think in those ways when I get reports like this. But
you,
I appreciate
it. You are going to see a decrease in SoCal High's scores, and it was due to testing atmosphere. And we're working with SoCal High to make sure that they have a better testing atmosphere for this coming school year. So you are going to see a dip in their scores. And I honestly don't think it's reflective of their students' lack of ability in math and or English language arts.
Do they always, because these are so new, do they always test the same way? I mean, there's a much larger student population at different schools. Do they all have to go to the library or something for this? I have no idea
so
how they
so
apply.
I did it in their like multi-purpose room gym-type situation, and the other schools did not do it that way.
Also known as the stage and auditorium and everything else there at that poor school. Okay, thank you.
Jeremy has a question.
Yeah, I would like to say publicly, I do discount the 11th grade tests, and I'm really looking for direction from the state to turn that into the, as we say, SAT, ACT. Because, you know, I do believe it's valuable to look at standardized tests, but 11th grade, you know, they haven't done it since 8th grade, and for a variety of reasons.
And I might add that these 11th graders have never taken the CASP. I think maybe this is the first year that they actually had seen the CASP in 8th grade, and then they're not testing it in 9th and 10th. So the years prior, it was like it was the first and only time they took the CASP.
Yeah, I don't want to be flippant about it, but it's just that it's a...
There's a lot of testing in 11th grade, SATs, AP tests, so they get tested a lot.
That's it.
Okay, anything else? Thank you so much. All right. Now we go to business services and the long-term debt report.
Hey. A couple quick slides for you here. Of the outstanding debt we have associated with our bonds and older bonds and one of the outstanding QZAB instruments that was used to do, I think it was B40 fields, right, Chris? So overall, kind of aggregate, looking at the long-term debt summary and the 18-19 annual payment. So we have principal and interest here overall for total amount owed, and then our annual payment here for 18-19 is at this line right here. So that's the principal interest payments related to the 18-19 school year. That's the aggregate payment we make for all of the different outstanding debt. General obligation bonds, this is looking at total amount at the secondary level, the prior bonds, 1998 election, and then the refunding of the 1998 election in 2013, and then the Measure A 2016, the amount that's been floated for that. And so the total amount of the secondary is on this line here. And this shows you your annual payment for 18-19. And then this shows you the source of funds that are paying off those debt instruments there on the far right hand side. Okay. Then on the elementary side, also the 1998 elections and the refunding as well, the Measure B issuance here for the 2016. Shows the total amount that's owed in this line here. And then in 18-19 shows what the annual payment is for the current year. And then it shows the source for you on the right-hand side here of the property taxes that you utilize for that. Okay? This is the old QZAB for the Bransfording Middle School project, the outstanding amount. Total owed here is on this line. And this shows you your annual payment for that. We make it for in 18-19 of that. And the RDA funds that we're receiving as part of the elimination of the RDA, Jerry Brown and Lee and the redevelopment agencies. And so those funds come to us that are committed towards capital. We're utilizing RDA funds to pay the outstanding amount for that. And then also, this is just kind of a recap of all those different things, the secondary and elementary combined, and the QZEP that's outstanding here. And again, listing the property tax as a sources, and then the RDA as a source for that QZEP amount that's right down there. Okay, so a quick recap for you of the outstanding long-term debt.
Okay. Jeremy.
I'd just like to say that you can buy Santa Cruz City School Board bonds, 5-year, 10-year, 15-year, 20-year, 25-year, 30-year, and I think they're paying like 3.25%. You know, they're not really high. We're not junk bonds. We're AAA or AA rated. And I think you have to buy them in blocks of 10 grand. So if you can shake $10,000 out of the tree, you could buy a Santa Cruz City School bond. It's pretty interesting to call them up and, you know, and pretend like you're a player and say, all right. But, you know, that's what's funding them, you know, and the interest rates are good, you know. So I just wanted to say that. I did want to ask Pat one serious question about RDA money. We used a lot of that to pay off other debts.
Right.
How much do we have of that? Are we?
I want to say we're in the $4 million range here, but I can give you the exact amount.
Okay.
And there's annual amounts that come in, about $1.3 million annually that are coming in.
Do you have any plans, or are you going to be bringing any plans to the board to use that money to pay off any of these other non...
We looked at paying off the QZAB.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But the QZAB has penalties associated with paying off earlier. So
now you've reminded me. Got it. Thank you.
We didn't do that. Okay.
Thank you. This is not my really good area, so pardon me if this is a stupid question, but I went to hear John Laird give the talk about propositions and what we should be voting for and thinking about, and one of the things he talked about was the whole thing of bonds and the necessity of them, but the balance always having to be, it's easy to do sometimes, more easy to do than one might want to do. And that was behind how we got, in California, we got in so much trouble. And so it made me want to ask, and then I saw this was on the thing, how we compare in terms of the average district or the average community, how we compare in terms of the amount of debt we carry. And I know you watch that because I've heard you talk about it.
Okay.
But I was just wondering where you consider the line is.
Well, I think there's also, to kind of go hand in hand what you're talking about, that communities investing in districts, and from the value of your investment, that investing in schools results in strong communities and results in strong property values. So it's a subjective thing. Although this is dollars and cents, it's a subjective thing as well, too. And the belief in your school board, belief in your school system, that you are getting value for investing in the community that you live in, which... So that's kind of a bit of a subjective answer to your question, too. But where's the line is kind of a subjective thing, but it goes back to belief in your schools. And where what your schools are providing to your children. So,
but are you seriously saying there wouldn't be a point where you'd say, you know, folks, this might look good to you, but you're tipping the scale?
Well, I think part of that has to do too with your bonding capacity. How much debt can you float? And that's associated with the debt that is that there is a limit in terms of what your tax base will permit you to float as debt.
And so, we hit our limit on the last bond, didn't we?
And we're
close to it.
Yeah, we're close to it. And, and with appreciation of your values, that you frees up some more debt that you can float also as you pay down other parts of the debt. Does that answer your question, Sheila?
Sort of. I mean, I don't know, because my question came from his thing, and it may not fit as well with the schools. But it really was, I was interested, he was talking about how Jerry Brown basically came in and everyone was floating as much debt as they could possibly float. And he said, we got to get rid of some of this. And that was really what turned California around. So he was describing to us, if we have three bonds on the coming up,
that we have to vote on, or is it four? I think it's three or four. And he was saying, you know, so with each one of them, you're looking, this is money that you are asking the people of the state of California to float this money for you. And so you really should be thinking, what value are we getting for each one of these things? And maybe after you said yes to three, you don't want to say yes to four, because you are now, you know, overloading the system. And if we have a bad year or a war or any other thing, you don't have any give. So that's what was making me think about it. I hadn't ever thought of it that way.
Yeah. Well, there's, like I said, there's the objective dollars and cents of it, but we've seen districts that are successful and districts that are unsuccessful with their bond measures. And much of that, my experience has been on the unfortunate districts that are unsuccessful in their endeavors, sometimes have been subjective in terms of, you know, the perception or other things that are going on. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balance, like you say. There's a subjective component and an objective component.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so good enough for
you. You and I could talk for a while about that.
All right. I know you could.
Cindy's next and then Jeremy.
Thanks. One quick question and then a comment to tag on to what Sheila said. Just refresh my memory on the grant supporting middle school, the qualified school construction bond. What did we do with those funds?
My recollection, Chris was, I mean, you were.
I wasn't on the board then.
So it was, we had had a field committee for many years, and we were trying to raise funds for field. We had gotten donated plans, and when our incentives came out during recession, the construction incentives, the district was able, because we had shovel-ready plans, to get a low-interest rate loan to accomplish that field project so that Brent Sporty could have a field similar to Mission Hill. And so that's what that was. And there's a lot of parents who gave many years past the time their kids were in school to see that through.
I see. And then to piggyback on what Sheila had said, and then John Laird, one of the obvious pieces he was pushing was a bond costs a lot more than the face value of a bond. So you want to... $200 million bond, you're not paying $200 million.
It's like, right.
You get
a
$800,000 mortgage, you're not paying
$800,000.
Right.
That
was his
name. You don't
want to
know about it.
In terms of the full cost of
right.
Of,
what is the cost?
Of the full cost.
Right. Right.
I just like to say that our bond, from everything I see, is very healthy, though. I mean, one of the earmarks of it is that low interest, and I believe, you know, it's still trading at 100% or close to. I mean, you know, you'd have to look at that, but it's not trading at, you know, 70 cents to the dollar. It's trading at
high value.
Yeah, at essentially 100% or 99%. So we're doing really good. And that's all. That's really important.
Credit guys look at the value of your tax base, right. The health of your tax base, I should
right.
say.
And our rating would change. Our rating would be the first thing that we as a board would see as the flag to know that, hey, let's, other than if we're not paying attention, wouldn't that change?
Well.
Or only when we go out for them is your rating
so,
assessed.
Yeah, when you get, well, they can go, they can adjust it. I mean, during that, you know, during that, after the whole Lehman crisis in, you know, Central Valley and the decline in the tax base, again, the rating is largely attributed to the health of your tax base.
Yeah.
And since this is a fabulous place to live and there's demand and, you know, houses can sell in a day or two, you know, right? So not a place, certainly, as you kind of wander outside the Bay Area to the greater Bay Area and outside of California, it's not always that way. You can sit on a house for years and not sell it. So...
So this is our first annual long-term debt report, and we will do them annually.
Right.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our next item is our new business, the hardware for the district card access security system.
Good evening all, officially. So what we have here is... kind of a response to what happened a long time ago at a place called Columbine.
due to that, there's actually been legislation passed now that as part of receiving home money, you are required to have what they call a combine box, which is the ability for someone on the inside of the room to lock them without going to the outside, no matter what the state of the door is in at the time, they can walk up and just lock it. So probably 99%+ of all the locks within the district don't have that ability. And in order to do that, we have to change them to new locks. That's a pretty significant expense. The other thing it doesn't do is it doesn't allow you to be proactive in a circumstance. It only allows you to be reactive. And it requires some sort of notice generally in order for a teacher to know that they need to go lock the door. The beauty of this system is it's got a multitude of possibilities. So at the classroom level, if something starts to happen and they need to lock the door, they can lock their own door without any permissions. As long as they've got their key card handy and they walk up to the door, they can lock it. If two of their neighbors do it at the same, within a set period of time, the system goes, whoa, something's going on, and locks it down because the system has a built-in intelligence. Some of that can be enhanced to make it where it only requires two, an extended period of time, but in essence, a localized thing can trigger a complete lockdown. The other thing it allows for is if the police department called the district office, was trying to get a hold of Chris to let her know there's a major event happening by one of the schools, and he would suggest they call them and put them on lockdown. She can actually put them on lockdown herself, right then and there on the spot. No calling, looking for a principal or someone at the site to actually do it. The principal at the site, of course, has the ability to do that, and we can designate other folks on the site the ability to do that. There's also a hot button in the front office where typically there's always somebody. They're usually always, unfortunately for them sometimes, the front line of defense in a circumstance, and it could be as simple as something you see on a regular basis where it's a child custody issue. A distraught parent coming in, they can actually activate it and all the doors lock down. So it has a multitude of features. The good news with this system is it is very, very cost effective. It's approximately double the cost of just changing locks, but it's about a third to a quarter of the cost of some of the other systems on the market that have been around quite a while. This system was developed at Santa Clara University, put into a number of universities, been in play for about 10 years or so, but it's a very small company and it's growing slowly. They focused on just colleges to begin with, and now they're expanding into K-12. This particular system, one of the advantages, we went through a series of kind of charrettes with the architects looking at what are the options, knowing we wanted to do something to be proactive for safety, and also knowing in order to be eligible for state money, we needed to at least meet that minimum standard. And was that good enough, or did we want to do something better? So we all thought we wanted to do something better, so we went through the process. So the system's primary advantages is the fact that it's completely and 100% wireless. Other than the access points that it communicates with, there is no wiring needed. Electronic doors are quite fiddly when it comes to the wire. You've got to get the wire down the wall, because all our sites are already built. We're not doing a lot of new buildings. You've got to get the wire down the jamb of the door, through the hinges, and then all the way across through the door to the latch. It's a lot of man hours, and that's why it's so expensive. They do have wireless components, and they do also have some wireless locks. The direct comparison that I can give you is the system we're using uses two AA batteries that last 5 to 6 years and give you about a 45 day warning via email and other alerts that they're going low. The other systems on the market use 6 to 8 AA batteries, and they last on a high-use door less than a year, but on average 1 to 2 years. So they're significantly more, less green, shall we say, which is also quite a focus. When we talk about batteries, that's something that throwing those things away kind of is not a good idea. But again, this one uses less than a quarter. And if you use the multiplier, Jeremy, you're really sharp in math. Do the math real quick for me. But, you know, 6 to 8 versus 2 and 5 to 6 years versus 1 to 2 years is significant. So primarily it's sort of a first line of defense for a multitude of things, And it really is driven by a need to try to provide our staff and our teachers a situation where, one, they have control, but there's also some global controls over it. So that's kind of fundamentally where we're at, if that makes sense.
Any questions? Jeremy.
Just a quick question. We don't have natural bridges on this list.
No.
Oh, how come?
It's not our site. We won't have keys. We won't be controlling their comings and goings because they're renters. We will have keys to their site, but we don't want to put our system on their site.
Okay, Patty.
And I'm sorry, my board pad is down and I don't have the presentation for numbers in front of me. Do the remotes need Wi-Fi? I mean, so when these remotes work or when you remotely activate, tell me the system that is being used. Artificial intelligence? Is it Wi-Fi?
It's Wi-Fi.
So if the Wi-Fi is down, what happens?
So internally, you still have complete 100% connectivity. It only if the power went down. So it's the Wi-Fi is not like the normal Wi-Fi you're using. It's the door's own internal system. It's a lot more stable than a typical Wi-Fi. If the communications between that site... So, as an example, if the power went down kind of area-wide and the server shut down, it wouldn't be possible for Chris to remotely control it from somewhere else. But all the functions on the site would be the same.
Okay. That piece, so it's not leaving.
And the doors will operate literally for 5 to 6 years without the server running, but they only run on the last set of controls. So when Mrs. Smith lost her key... power goes down and we give her a new key until the power comes up and it reconnects to the server, she won't be able to get in. So it might be...
But you can get out. You can always get out.
Okay. And that's a good point. There's a lot of products on the market now that people are touting just because they're cheap, whereby you can quickly lock a door from the inside. You slip a sleeve over the closure arm so it won't open. You put a board on the door. You use these wedges and other things.
It's a problem if the person is within you.
And there's other problems as well. Yeah. What if the alarm went off because it's a massive gas leak? It really is a big fire. And you've put that in and clammed it into the corner and you put your desks up and you've done all this stuff to hide and cover. And then all of a sudden you feel heat coming through the wall, smoke comes through. Now you panic. So what do? You run straight to the door that for the last million times you just levered the door and went straight open. Now it doesn't.
Huh.
And there's 20, 30 kids trailing you, or they're the ones that went first.
So
that's a problem. Whereas this system doesn't allow for that to happen. It still functions just like it did yesterday.
Okay, and just a follow-up. So this is legislation that's led us to this. And... Will we be using the, if I'm understanding you correctly, we're using the existing doors?
Yes.
Okay, so if we have sites where the existing doors are problems, will they be, the doors be replaced at Soquel High? You can shake all the hallway doors open. They chain them.
Right. So this is kind of independent of the door issue. There's going to be lots and lots of doors replaced because they're in bad condition. That's a great example. This is just going to happen... on the new doors, on the replaced doors, on old doors that are still good. It's also a very easy install process. Typically, it takes about 15 minutes to do the swap over. So from an installation standpoint, I'm trying to work through a series of scenarios where we can try to do it quickly without interrupting the sites and really cost-effectively with a small, efficient crew that we're going to try to put together and do some force accountability, for lack of a better term.
Can you repeat that, please?
It's called force account work. It's like we'll hire some people direct to us, and then we'll hire an expert to train them, and then we set this crew loose, and we really pay them by the hour to do the work. I'm hoping to do it for less than $500,000, but at this point in time, we're still exploring the options and the technical expertise available to do it.
Thank you. Jeremy.
Two questions, and you just answered one. We have the total materials cost at $2 million, but we don't have an estimate.
I don't have the.
So you guess a $500,000 to do this?
I'm hoping it's going to be less than that, but I'm, that would be kind of, I think, in the ballpark based on what the manufacturer is telling us.
And secondly, this isn't to be found in the facility's master plan, is it? This is a, sort of a 1%. It looks like about a 1% expense at every site that we just now have to do.
It was talked about at a lot of the different site meetings as an option for safety.
Right.
But not necessarily as a global plan. And in looking at, you know, after we get started in this business and we start looking at why would we want to do it at one site and not another, it works better if we have uniformity across the district. And so it sort of became obvious that this is more of a district plan rather than a site-by-site plan.
Cindy, then Dee Dee, and Sheila, and Maddie.
Thank you.
A couple of quick questions. You said this was used at Santa Clara University. This company has 10 years of experience. Do we know of a K-12 district where this has been used?
None of our size. There's some smaller 2 and 3 school districts that are using it. Nothing of our size. We'll be kind of the first, for lack of a better term, large district that they put it in on a K-12 situation.
And the smaller districts where it's been installed for K-12, you've talked with them?
Every single person I've talked to, without exception, has been ecstatic about the results, surpassed their expectations. You know, there's a few stories of teething pains where, you know, Mrs. Smith's key didn't operate the things they thought it did. That was usually human error, not mechanical error. So there's some teething issues there, which we've got a plan to make sure we limit for us. Other than that, everyone's been really, really happy with it. And long term as well. The folks at Santa Clara University absolutely swear by it.
I have a couple of other questions. I'll defer.
Okay. Dee Dee?
Go ahead.
You talked about the batteries. Is that per classroom?
Per door.
So we have 1,389.
We end up with about 4,000 batteries.
But the battery that has to be changed is in each classroom. So it's
2 per door.
However many there are. Mm-hmm. So that's a 2 per door. So that's... So we have every classroom is going to have batteries that are operating effectively to make this thing work.
About every 5 years, we will have replaced about 4,000 batteries.
And that would become part of our maintenance crew?
Yeah, I mean, we won't have a single key. We really won't have any keying necessary, so that position of locksmith now really becomes a position of making sure the hinges are right, making sure the closures work. Typically, you keep everything tight, but instead of doing key work, we're just doing battery work.
And final question. You said we all got together and we looked at this and thought this was the best way to go. I would assume that included site administrators,
we've talked to all the sites and at all the bond
committees
and at the site level as well, three architectural groups. And then after one of our large... lease-back contractor partners heard about what we were doing. They actually went and did their own show-and-tell of the company and came back and were absolutely ecstatic about it. And they're actually implementing it now at some other districts they're working at.
Thanks.
Okay.
So we have a similar system on our campus, but this system is much, much better in the fact that it can be centrally operated locally and then just by each individual classroom. And I think this is phenomenal that our district is going to have this capability and that the individual teachers can ensure their own safety, but Chris at the district office can do it for the whole entire school site. Mm-hmm. And thinking of it as part of our modernization of our schools really helped me look at that $2 million price tag and say, yeah, it's worth it. So I think it's going to be a good thing for our schools and safety more than anything.
Yeah. And anecdotally, one thing I did forget to mention, Mission Hill Middle School and
the 40 middle school or two in particular that come to mind, where they have parking lots that have gates, where the staff has to come and go via these gates. And there's always this issue of who's opening the gate, do they open and close it, once they're in, how do they get out? They're stopping their cars with cars backed into the street to open gates. This system comes, every door lock comes with its own what they call a fob, just like your car keys have typically. That thing's programmable by distance from 0 to 100 feet. So these folks that park in these parking lots, the rolling gates we plan to put in will have this system on it. So as they drive up, the gate will automatically open for them. So they don't have to stop, get out, unlock the gate. B40 in particular is a parking lot that's almost not used because of the problems of the gate. Mm-hmm. And so we're hoping that by installing this in here, they'll take, you know, 30 cars off the local streets and also hopefully make their vehicles safer and safer for the kids coming and going, and just be kind of a bonus all the way around. Mm-hmm.
Another bonus, I think, of this is it also lets us know who's in the building. So you always have a record of which staff are there. If you're, you know, one of the things that's a concern is having people sign in and out of campus. You want to know which adults are in the building. If you're doing a, you know, there's been an incident, you know who was there, and you know who you need to account for in each space. Even if they were on prep, are they still on campus? You'll know because they've done their key card to get into their classroom or into it. It also allows us to program if we have someone. You know, we have a lot of itinerant staff, coaches and things. It, you can program when they have access to the school and when they have access to which buildings they have access to. So we've had issues in the past with keys being duplicated and facilities being used that hadn't been signed out for or rented or registered in. This will help us also kind of manage that in a way that that we haven't been able to in the past.
Sheila, I just want to be sure I'm right that this is part of the bond money?
Yes.
Okay.
And Patty?
Mine is a process question. Can you tell many, how many companies you researched before you made this decision?
Three different companies.
Primarily
there's one major heater in the market, Asset Alloy. They're kind of the premier company in the market, which is the one we first started looking at. Until we started seeing the cost tag, and we thought there's got to be a better alternative. And then, ironically, I found out about this company through an ex-employee who called me and said, "You were talking about electronic door locks." And she was over in Santa Clara. And they've got a system here that you might be interested in. That's how it came about.
Can you piggyback on this, Trevor?
Yes.
And so with this and the cost of the other systems, normally you give us a bid.
So
all
I got
these
prices from the other systems.
Are they comparable, or you know, could we have them listed so that to cover our process for the public to how we determine this? You know, what sort of cost pieces were associated with each that you checked out?
So the Asset Alloy, which is the kind of like I said, the king of the market, they are in excess of $10 million.
And the third.
And the other one was about $6 million.
Okay, and then I think that Cindy asked about who made the decision. So everybody was at the table prior, meaning the site administrator, and then those who needed to know in the upper level of what's going to happen in case we need to use the system.
So technically we made it amongst the professional group, so to speak, and then as far as just... this is the type of system we're going to install, explaining what it does, how it works, that's been done at every site.
Thank you.
Jeremy.
I have a surveillance question. I mean, last week I made a joke about Johnny being late for class. I mean, we're able, with this system, to track teachers, so we can now say, "Mr. Smith, you're 2 minutes late for lunch because you're not back on campus." I mean, you've sort of touched on this.
Technically,
and I just
you could. I mean, however, that's a lot of free time somebody has to sit around and look at that kind of thing.
True, but I just want to raise it.
So
I got the fob, and then I've got the
key card.
The key card, and that allows, let us just say, the principal to know where I am at any moment.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say any moment, but yeah, it does give you an indication. So I put a system an older version of the wired system like this in the Paso Robles in the late 80s.
Okay.
And one of the things we discovered is our nighttime custodians were not going to the classrooms they said they were going to. So it did become a tool in that thing, and we had discussions with the union, and you know, because it's not where you want to use this to track people, but when you start trying to find things out and something goes wrong, and you look at data and you see things, you can't just ignore them. So it becomes information that now leads to other things. So it, yes, it can be used that way, but for anyone that has enough time to do that, I mean, that would be a full-time job.
I can't see us doing that unless there's an emergency and we need to find somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay, and if we have union representation here, that mm-hmm. was my point. If unions are okay with it, then okay.
It has been brought to us.
It's not what we're planning to use it for. It's a safety measure.
I've got this strange vision of the Marauders map at Hogwarts where you can see where everybody is.
I hadn't even thought about this.
I swear I'm up to no good. You know,
this hadn't, you know, I'm going to tell you, it didn't even cross my mind.
I was thinking about
search and rescue, and I was thinking about...
Yeah.
You
hit the right there.
Okay, so Dee.
Just wanted to raise it.
What day it comes to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What about upkeep, maintenance, repair of the system? If it breaks down, do we have to pay the company to come in and repair?
The beauty of this system is literally you just take a spare device and swap it out. Each one has an own individual address. You just put that address instead of the previous one, and within a few seconds, it's fully functional. Removal and replacement of these things literally is once you've done one, that swap over is maybe 5 minutes.
Okay.
It's very, very simple. The actual hardware itself, I forget the term, it's an ANSI, A-I-N-S-I term. Anyway, it's a million cycle hardware device, so it should operate at least a million times before something fails. So it's premium stuff. You can't really buy any better. So the functionality and maintenance sustainability should be very, very good.
Questions or comments from the public? Okay, it's an action item. Do we have a motion?
Ms. Approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, 6-0. Thank you, Trevor. Okay, our next item is the resolution.
The resolution committee is bringing forward Measure G, a 0.5% sales tax that will provide funding for essential county services such as sheriff, fire, emergency response, local street maintenance, pothole repair, mental health services, substance use disorder and health care services, homelessness programs, parks, youth and senior programs, economic development and job creation, affordable housing, and other essential county services. These essential services are important in supporting district students and families. So there is recommendation that the board take action as appropriate on this resolution 081819 in support of ballot measure G.
Comments or questions? From the public? The motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Okay, Patty and Dee.
Thank you.
The resolution? Jeremy?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
Okay. Resolution Committee is bringing forward Resolution 9-18-19 in support of Measure H, Santa Cruz County Housing Solution Bond. If adopted by voters, Measure H will provide $119 million to local jurisdictions of Santa Cruz County to create affordable housing opportunities for local residents and workers. In addition, Measure H will also provide $21 million for the creation of facilities to address homelessness countywide. If passed, the measure would provide resources to support the development of workforce housing for Santa Cruz City schools employees.
Questions?
Move approval.
Second.
We'll have to go to the public. Any questions or comments?
They look tired.
Still have to do it.
Any comments from the public?
All right. Go ahead, Sheila.
I move approval.
Second.
And a second was Dee Dee. Thank you.
Okay. Jeremy?
Aye.
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 Resolution 10-18-19 is in support of celebrating the month of October as LGBTQ plus History Month. The Santa Cruz City Schools Board of Education supports the rights, freedom, and equality of those who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. The board also believes that all students deserve to feel safe and welcome in their schools and see themselves represented in the curricula. The board has also adopted and supports the new social studies framework, which includes the FAIR, Accurate, Inclusive, and Respectful Education Act. The FAIR Act mandates the inclusion of the political, economic, and social contribution of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people in the social studies and history curricula in California public schools. In honor of the contribution of LGBTQ plus leaders, many districts are designating the month of October as LGBTQ plus History Month, and the Resolution Committee brings this forward to the board for your consideration.
Questions or comments? Their motion.
Move approval.
Second.
Sheila and Dee Dee again.
Thank you so much.
And it's a resolution.
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, our next item is board policy updates, first and or final reading. Do we have thoughts about this?
No, first.
Okay.
First, yes.
Yes, that was mine. Just to hope that it was the first reading,
first
and we'll
reading.
Bring it back. I'm
next
sorry,
week.
Yeah, which is next, literally next week.
Next week. Yes.
So, depending on the board book, again, there might be some shuffling.
Okay, so we need a motion.
Yes, we need a motion for first.
For first,
I move to have this as a first reading,
and I second it.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
If you have specific questions about any of them, please send. Most of them are just like the others where it's a legal update.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now our last item on here is the possible items for future meeting agendas, and we did have some notes about our previous presentation. Any additional?
Yeah, I thought it was really helpful when Dee Dee and I met with Dorothy and Chris, and it was just a 45-minute meeting to give input for the sort of the, it's not a round table, but the...
Our study session.
Our study session on, it'll focus on social science and computer science in November. And so I'm wondering, and I would certainly volunteer myself, if it would be appropriate, if you think, for board members to participate, one or two or three if they wish, in planning the next presentation by our directors so that we're really on the same page in this.
Wondering if I could make it a part of my October trustee meetings with all of you to gain your input on like more you'd like to know to help inform. Would that work to
probably
do that?
Probably a better idea. Yeah.
Would that work?
Yeah.
And so as we meet next week, to start our October trustee meeting, does that work for everybody?
I think so. I think it can be prepared.
Yeah, I think we had some notes too to start with.
And as I think it's very important, could I say that could you then bring that back to us at some point and we are all on the same page in terms of what we'll be receiving in the next meeting?
So what if I put that in the October meeting? I solicit your input for the November meeting. We bring back everybody's input for everyone to see, to inform, then I can work then with Dorothy and her team to give them what you like to see in a next presentation.
Sounds good.
Sounds
okay. And did we determine that the next presentation would fall within 6 months? Can it, I don't have the governance calendar for our meetings. Can you look into that for the calendar?
I think the agenda committee can look at it and
okay,
then
thank you.
See where we can
yeah. Yeah. To see where it can fit in.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.
Okay. Just say it.
A
short agenda, but we skipped our second presentation in our first. We can't do this, and they integrated. And it was funny because Jeremy, I'm glad that Jeremy and Jeremy brought it up in that manner, because it could be such what it really was taped. It's not what we did.
He wasn't the other person who's running. I have no idea. It's rare that someone new sits through a whole meeting. Especially a long meeting like this, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing. I don't know what it is.
Same
thing.
Yeah. Oh, respectful.
Oh, the gentleman sitting right here? Yeah, I wasn't sure. I thought he was a vendor, looking to make sure we have something.
Patty, can I ask a favor?
To carry something? Recycle something?
Mystery. Mystery day.
All right.
Let's take some of our money and invest it. Google.